the long wire was minus 7, and the antenna, the Antron 99, had a return loss of minus 8. So the Antron had the worst return loss, a better return loss than the long wire, but it received much, much worse on that particular frequency. I'm sort of wondering why. What is actually, is there something going on behind the scenes that I'm not seeing here? Now, bear in mind, this is not for transmitting. This is just for receiving purposes.
Yeah, you're on to an interesting set of clues here, Joe. When you measure return loss, and you tell me minus 6 dB, minus 8 dB, minus 3 dB, whatever, of return loss, that is the magnitude of the reflected signal. Every reflected signal has not only a magnitude, but a particular phase angle, depending on the exact impedance of the antenna at that frequency. You tell me the resistive component and the reactive component of the impedance of your antenna at your particular frequency. In theory, I can tell you with an equation or with a Smith chart not only how big is the reflected signal, how big is the standing wave ratio, so to speak, but what is its phase angle. Depending on the way your front end of your receiver works, I can take, let me pick a number, a minus 6 dB return loss. I don't know the exact number, but maybe that's a 2.8 to 1 standing wave ratio. However, as I go from 0 to 90 to 180 to 70 degrees of reflected phase angle, your receiver is going to behave very differently. If the receiver was a pure 50 ohm resistor, that wouldn't matter. No receiver is a pure 50 ohm resistor. So you told me the magnitude of the reflected signal, you didn't tell me the phase angle. We're now discovering the phase angle is another big variable as far as your receiver is concerned. Let me drop. The possibility exists that if the reflected phase angle was minus 90 degrees, you'd get very high reception on the receiver. And if it was minus 270 degrees of phase angle, you'd get a hell of a lot less, depending on how the front end of your receiver works. If this is the best of all worlds, your receiver front end would have the equivalent of a Pi tuning network where you could make it match all possible impedances. Our receivers don't have that. And so what the manufacturer did is assume the antenna is a 50 ohm source and using a 50 ohm transmission line, and he made the front end work well with that source impedance. Doesn't mean the receiver is 50 ohms. With some difficulty, you could put a vector network analyzer on the input terminals of your receiver. I guarantee if you could keep the signal small or low enough so you're not saturating the receiver, guarantee you'd see some pretty wild results. No receiver is a 50 ohm load. So that other variable, the phase angle, is what I think you're running headlong into, Joe. W2LYY, K2LIW in the deck man.
Okay, well, doing the same measurement on a much lower frequency, like 1010 kilohertz, the long wire received a signal level of minus 42 dBm, the disc cone was minus 75, and the antenna, what's called Antron 99, was minus 82. That had the best return loss. So I can start to see what you're talking about, but it seems like there's a huge difference in signal level low. The return loss on that frequency is 1.5 with the Antron 99. It was 0.6 dB with the long wire, and about minus 2 dB with the disc cone. But the long wire had a substantially higher signal level than the other two antennas. As I said, on high frequency, it was much different, but on low frequency, there was a drastic difference in signal levels.
If there are approximately four parameters you're playing with here, Joe. Each of those antennas has a certain polarization, horizontal, vertical, circular, slant. Every antenna has got a slightly elliptic polarization. So each antenna has got a different polarization. On the frequencies where you're doing the measurements, each of these antennas have a hugely different gain, an antenna pattern. Some of those antennas where you're using them on a frequency they weren't designed for could have a null in the direction of where winds 1010 is, or a peak. So antenna gain in that direction because of its azimuth and elevation of the arrival of the signal, that makes a huge difference in the signal strength. When you measure the visual of the antenna and you're measuring reflection color, provisioned, that tells you how close the antenna is to a 50-ohm load. I could give you an antenna that's a beautiful 50-ohm load. It's a 50-ohm resistor with slightly long leads on it. The slightly long leads means that a little bit of the signal gets radiated. A towel bar antenna, let me drop. A towel bar antenna comes close to that. A towel bar antenna can easily cover 10 to 1 in frequency region. And it's a very good, it's under a 2 to 1 standing wave ratio across a 10 to 1 frequency region. That's the good news. The bad news on the low end, it has minus 20 dB of gain compared to isotropic. At the high end, it might be minus 5. At the low end, it's minus 20. So a leaky 50-ohm resistor would give you a very low return loss. In other words, a minus 25 dB return loss, so to speak, a 1.1 standing wave ratio, but it's got terrible gain because there's very little antenna there, just the extended resistor. So the variables you're playing with, gain in the direction of arrival of the signal, standing wave ratio, phase angle of the reflection, magnitude of the reflection, you're playing with, and what is the exact impedance of your receiver. So there's a bunch of variables here, Joe. And so the gain of an antenna, according to the IEEE standards for antenna measurement procedures, let me drop. The gain of the antenna is that property you measure after you have impedance matched it. Well, in the real world, if your antenna has got a 50 to 1 standing wave ratio, even though the antenna might have 5 dB of gain, you may think it's got 15 dB of loss because of the standing wave ratio and the way it interfaces with your particular receiver. The IEEE would not call that a minus 15 dB antenna. They call it a plus 5 because standing gain is something you measure after you've impedance matched it. So, as you can tell, there's more variables here than first meets the eye, Joe. You're going through a very educational process. As a kind of a scientist, the V2LYY, KQLIW.
Well, I can only do what I can do with the instrumentation I have. I don't have a, you know, $30,000 or $40,000 vector network analyzer to play with like some people do. So I have to sort of, you know, just deal with what I have. But it just brings up the curiosity of just, you know, trying to get some, you know, a better handle on things with how I measure things and how I see things observed with the test equipment I do have on hand for myself.
That IFR you've got is a darn good spectrum analyzer, a darn good thing for measuring return loss, I believe. I think it can measure return loss. It measures magnitude of return loss. There may be a way that you can force it to measure the phase angle of the return loss. Yes, there is. I didn't say it's easy. There are ways you can add some extra doodads on the output side of your IFR, your service monitor. If it has the ability to measure return loss, I think it does, you can force it to measure phase angle of the return loss. I'm going to think about how to tell you how to do that, but I know it's possible. And it doesn't have to cost you a whole lot. If you had the money to buy a $30,000 vector network analyzer, brand new from Rode & Schwartz, and it gives you accuracy to the nearest tenth of a dB when measuring return loss and to the nearest 1 degree of phase angle, that's nice. You and I don't need that. I mean, you want to know, is the return loss a minus 30 degree angle or a plus 90 degree angle? That's the kind of thing you and I want to know. The exact number of degrees is not that important. You just want to know the ballpark. So there's ways you can get that, Joe, once you recognize that you are playing with one of those variables. So B2LYY, K2LAW.
Just out of curiosity, what model I am playing?
Go ahead, Joe.
Sorry, I didn't hear that, not enough audio.
He wants to know the model number of your IFR.
1500. And that has tracking generator built into the unit. So I have to use an external return loss bridge to be able to measure return loss on an antenna circuit. There's no way for me to measure phase, not with the two items that I have.
So you do have that return loss bridge, Joe? Is that what you just said? Because you are measuring return loss?
Yep.
Yeah, I'm hearing Joe. Hearing Joe on the internet. He said his return... you there. Please listen on the input frequency. I'm hearing an S9 signal right now, for instance. And please report it to Limark.org. RFI at Limark.org. So tell us what signal strength you measured, what time you measured it. So, Eric, now that you know he does have that external 1 meg to 1,000 meg return loss bridge on his IFR 1500, are you about to tell us, Eric, that you've come up with a technique for measuring phase angle of return loss? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
K2RIW, K2EJ. No, I'm just curious as to which model that he had, because the later model that actually set up two directional couplers doesn't have a second point receiver. But I haven't used it, but I've seen it.
I wonder, Joe, do you own a stub tuner or a trombone? I wonder if you own either one of those devices, Joe, go ahead.
Negative.
Okay. That makes life a little bit more difficult. I'm going to think about it this week, but with your return loss bridge that you use with your 1500 IFR, I know there's a way you can make phase angle to the nearest 30 degrees, which is good enough. I know there's a way it can be done. I'm going to think about how to tell you how to do that. But right now, that's a little bit academic. You're discovering that your antennas have different gains. That makes a big difference on the signal strength you get. Your antennas, in some cases, you're using them out of their designed frequency region. And so the variables are gain, signal strength, return loss, phase angle, and the exact impedance of your receiver at the particular frequency. All of that being mishmashed together, and the net result is a minus 85 or a minus 62 dBm signal measured on the IFR or on the receiver. Okay, anything else you want to discuss tonight before we cut you off, Joe? The V2RYY, you're making progress. K2RIWZNet. I know you're frustrated. Believe it or not, one of the things they told us in college, when you're most frustrated, usually it's when you're really learning the most. You got it, Joe?
Reference. This subject is something related to it. Well, whatever. You said anything else you want to discuss? But the answer would be yes. I'll give you a quickie. You've talked about transmit receiving systems using spread spectrum technology. And it seems like these things are almost impervious to interference. But in some cases, I think they may not be as good as that. If you're using a system that's, say, it's spread over maybe a certain small range of frequencies, maybe 28 megahertz, 30 megahertz, something like that, and you've only got that much bandwidth to play with, if you had something interfere with you or generate a rather large level signal of interference, not less than wrong terminology, a high level of interference, but of course being broadband all at once, would that in some cases start approaching the point where it started crunching the receiver and making the receiver not hear stuff correctly as it was intended to? Back to you.
So that depends upon the modulation technique.
Yeah, Eric is right on. It turns out the word spread spectrum is an extremely broad word, pun intended, Joe. There are zillions of kinds of spread spectrum signals in the system. The ones that are being set up for military electronics countermeasures techniques, countermeasures techniques, literally is, in some cases, a frequency hopper where there is a pseudo-random code that both the transmitter and the receiver knows as to what frequency for the next millisecond is going to be the transmit frequency. And you try to jam that thing because it's frequency hopping over a huge frequency region, but it knows what the next frequency is going to be for the next millisecond, so to speak, and the receiver goes there and the transmitter goes there. You try to jam that, and boy, it's tough. And some of those systems have got enough smarts where if there is a strong jamming signal on one of those frequencies, it stops using that frequency for that period of time. And because there's enough forward error correcting in the way the message is being sent in packets, even though it's lacking some of the packets because of that jammed frequency, is able to put it all back together. That is a kind of spread spectrum system. There are other kinds. So would a strong jamming signal crash a spread answer is, has the signal get strong enough? The answer is yes, but there are ways around that. And there are times when the strong signal might be, let me pick a number, 30 dB above threshold, and yet the system goes right on keeping working, depending on if it's the right kind of spread spectrum. So there's a zillion kinds of spread spectrum systems, Joe. It's not just one technique. MIMO is another thing that comes close to this. Let me turn it over to Eric for some words on this, because he's been in the field a little bit longer than I have, this particular portion. KE2EJ, tell us your experience with spreads.
Repeater, timeout.
KE2EJ, K2LAW, go ahead, Eric.
I just waited for that to drop. Sounds like we got somebody on ILP or something. Is that right? Anyway, by the way, I was going to ask you, Dick, the military systems that you have experience with ODFM. There's a number of different modulation techniques that we use. If you want to talk Wi-Fi, which is kind of really bland, it's a direct sequence spread spectrum, where the sequence is well known between the receivers. Like military systems, which will actually is a pseudo-random number generator to create the next group of sequence. But there's different modulation formats and different types of FEC. FEC may actually be spread across the spectrum. Smart spread spectrum systems that are not direct sequence will actually listen and look for a response at multiple spikes, sort of like a tone filter. It depends. Like a Wi-Fi system, if you have a Wi-Fi spectrum analyzed, you can actually see multiple Wi-Fi signals all on the same channel, all talking to each other perfectly without any interference from one another. And it's a direct sequence. But where the sequence starts and stops will be the way that they interleave with each other and they don't bang into each other. Take that carrier, a really strong carrier, a W signal. The Wi-Fi DSS basically says, I don't see anything. So there's a lot of different forms. There's ODFM, there's other kinds of orthogonal modulation that they use, which actually will cut through a lot of stuff. Why, I'm sure in the military countermeasure, they do some really weird things to try and confuse that, but it's a really difficult task. K2RWK.
Repeater, timeout.
Your timing was perfect, Eric. You timed it out just as you said the very last word. One beautiful example of a kind of rather immune spread spectrum system, is the, all of a sudden I can't think of the name of the damn thing, the satellite locating system. Why can't I think of the name of it?
Stop the inbox, Matthews.
I'm talking about, every one of us has got a kind of receiver in our automobile.
GPS.
Say it again.
GPS.
The one. That's the one. Global Positioning Satellite System. Mine went blank. In the case of a civilian code, it is sending out 1 million bits per second of phase modulated signal. You know the exact frequency it's on, but it's a phase modulated signal with a million bits per second. Maybe it's a million 0.045, you know, was, in other words, an exact 2 to the n number, but it's roughly a million. The military version of that is 10 million bits per second. Each individual satellite has its own digital code. They're all 1 million bits per second. They all are a balance code. That's my word for it. I can't think of the name of it. In other words, the number of ones and the number of zeros of each code is very close to 50%, but they've got 30 different codes. So each satellite is on the exact same frequency. Let me drop. Each satellite is on the exact same frequency. And satellite number 5, so to speak, is using code number 5. And when your receiver says, I want to listen to code number 5, it does a back-end processing looking for the correlation of that particular code. And it ignores all other codes, even though they're on the exact same frequency. At first you would say, hey, these satellites are all jamming each other. Not really. The back-end processing of that particular code gives it a 30 or 35 dB of signal-to-noise ratio advantage when it's listening to that code compared to the other 29 codes. So that's one kind of spread spectrum. You try to jam that, even though it's an extremely weak signal. You'd be amazed how much signal strength power you need in order to jam that, because it's got so much integration. In the case of the military one, where it's integrating 10 million bits per second, and it's really getting, I think, 20 bits per second is the real data being sent at the rate of 10 million bits per second of a phase modulated carrier. That's one of the zillion kinds of spread spectrum. So the word spread spectrum is a very broad set of words, Joe. There's a lot of computer processing going on with each of these systems. They all have their individual advantages and disadvantages. I know I haven't answered your question, but I think I've at least given you a little bit more information. W2RYY, K2IW in the TechNet.
And then gold code, ETQIS.
That's the word I'm looking for, the gold codes. There's roughly 30 different gold codes. The word gold code means that it has exactly 50% ones and zeros in the code, and each of these codes are digitally orthogonal. What that means is that when you tell your receiver, I want you to now lock on to code number 27, I want you to listen to satellite number 27, I want you to ignore all the others, there's roughly a 30 or a 35 dB advantage in signal-to-noise ratio of listening to that code in the presence of all the other satellites on the exact same frequency transmitting their code. The back-end integration of that signal demodulation process has all of that magic. Ain't that crazy, Joe? W2LYY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, it kind of is, but, you know... Yeah, I know GPS can be bothered by the other things, other carriers on the, you know, that they come within range of the receiver, but they have to be something strong enough where it'll take it out. But I know this question sort of came up because I know local power companies were use this kind of system to communicate throughout the system to be able to turn stuff on and off remotely, and occasionally they do have interference on their system. And I know sometimes these power poles can put out a tremendous amount of noise if you get a bad joint up there, or an insulator or something. I know they go out, they generate a lot of stuff on HF, and imagine it probably goes up and becomes even, it can be probably severe on the higher frequency stuff too, around 450 and even maybe as high as 900, depending on the initial strength of the energy being produced, of the interference. Back to you.
I'm amazed how weak that the four beeps are right now. The arcing over power line, probably a 37 kilovolt power line of a particular pole near a cell phone base station. There's a base station on Long Island, I won't tell you where it is, that I was called upon to investigate one day, where the power line arcing over 38 or 67 kilovolt power line was probably 150 feet away from the antennas of the cell site. And my goodness, did that give them grief. Nowhere near as much grief as you would think. You look on a spectrum analyzer at all the arcing and sparking coming out of that, into an antenna from that arcing pole pig setup, substation, I guess you would call it. You would think you'd never be able to receive it. Well, the cell site was working, but just that it was about 20 dB low in sensitivity in one of its sectors, one of its your alpha, bravo, or gamma. In other words, each of your 120 degree wide sections, the one that looked in the direction of that power line was at least 20 dB down in sensitivity, and that was giving them a fair amount of grief. The fact that the system could work at all in the presence of all that arcing and sparking is kind of amazing to me. Okay, I think I'm going to send it back to you for a final, Joe, and we're about to go over to John for the mailbag. To meet you, RYY, for any final, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. No more questions for this episode.
And Joe, keep those cards and letters coming. That's what, John, when it comes to the way they communicate with you, John, I am guessing that 95% of it is email, and 5% of it is U.S. snail mail. And some of it, I guess, they might even call you up on the telephone. So, of all the mailbag communications you get, John. What are the approximate percentages as to the methods that they use? KC2WGB, our mailbag expert, K2RI, Zephyr Clay, John.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Everyone on the net. Mostly email. Get a few snail mails. No phone calls, thank God. I get enough of them. but emails are the mainstay. And I get maybe one a week, one every 2 weeks in the U.S. mail. They're always good. I'll take those two. All right. Let me let it drop again. That didn't sound right. And I'll go on to the first one.
I think for a bunch of reasons, what's the work Eric is doing, I think the four beeps are very low in amplitude tonight. You listen carefully, you'll hear them.
There's an ILP station that don't have the pulse set setting correct. I'm thinking about disconnecting the ILP, and that problem will go away. Unfortunately, we're using a reflector, and I can't single out the station. So if I do it, everybody goes.
I think we can tolerate the way it is right now, Eric. So go right ahead, John. Just that you have to listen to very low amplitude, four beeps.
No problem. I just turned volume up a little bit, and I took care of that. Okay. First question comes from a young amateur about a ballon. Now, he understands basic function of a ballon, but when it comes to the one-to-one ballon, he figures one-to-one, what is the purpose, why is it used, and how does it work? Maybe you could help him out with that, Dick. Back to you, KC2WGB.
Yeah, when a person uses a balloning device on his antenna, quite often he's using it both as a ballon and as an impedance match. It might be a 4-to-1 ballon, a 9-to-1 ballon. In other words, it's making that much of an impedance ratio between input and output. A 1-to-1 ballon still is a very valuable thing, even though it's not changing the impedance. It really is a unity isolation transformer. A 1-to-1 transformer on a 60-cycle line, in many cases, is a very safe thing to do because the 60-cycle line, for a whole bunch of reasons, that comes into your house, one of the two phases that comes into a modern-day house is the so-called red wire, and the other one is the black wire. The red wire is 120 volts to ground. The black wire is 120 volts to ground. The red to black wire is 240 volts between them. Because each one of those red wires and black wires is with reference to ground, if you're standing in seawater, your finger touches just one wire, red or black, you're in a hell of a lot of trouble. That current can flow between that red wire, your body, and Earth, even though it doesn't go back to the return lead that's in the socket that you just made contact to. Just touching one wire and your feet being grounded by some other means can give you a lot of grief. Let me drop. If you're using a one-to-one transformer, where the primary is connected to Con Ed or Loco, and the secondary is giving you 120 volts across those two wires. Now, if your secondary winding on that isolation transformer is thoroughly floating, it's not being connected to some other piece of equipment that has its own internal ground. If you're just touching one of those wires, let's assume now that your secondary winding has a red wire and a white wire, and which might be the real coloring, by the way. And you touch the red wire or you touch the white wire, one at a time, while your feet are standing in salt water. No problem. The circuit, the completely floating secondary winding, requires a load resistor, so to speak, to go from the red wire to the white wire, in my example, before current will flow. Whereas when you touch the primary, you just touch the red, don't even touch the white, you're in trouble, because way back at the power station, there is a grounded lead, and the earth completes that circuit. So even though you think you're only touching one wire, your feet are touching the other wire, so to speak, even though you don't see it. So an isolation transformer used in your shack can give you a lot of increased safety with reference to a shocking potential. It's not a cure-all, but it makes an improvement. That's one of the many improvements you get out of a one-to-one transformer. Let me drop. Now let's talk about your dipole antenna in your backyard. What many of us have done is you take your coax cable. The coax cable has got a 50-ohm impedance. Your dipole is a 70-ohm impedance. It's only a 1.3 standing wave ratio. It's nothing to lose a lot of sleep about. So that you connect the coax cable directly to your dipole. Assuming you're doing this on 40 meters. You've got a 67-foot long dipole, and in the center, you've got two leads coming out of the dipole. You connect one of them to the center conductor of your transmission line. You connect the other one to the shield. On paper, that looks like it might be a pretty good technique. The real signal in the coaxial cable is on that center conductor. In theory, the outer conductor of your coax cable is ground. In theory, it has no signal. In theory, when it's properly used. However, the way a dipole works, Mother Nature insists on symmetry. Because you think you're applying the signal from the center conductor to only the right-hand side of your dipole, and the left-hand side is connected to the shield, you think you're only feeding half the dipole. Well, Mother Nature doesn't like that. The way a dipole works and the way it couples to space, she wants it to be balanced. If your coax cable, let me drop it. If there's 100 volts on that center conductor of your transmission line, your coax cable, in theory there's 100 volts on that center conductor and 0 volts on the shield. Therefore, that center conductor connecting to the right-hand side of your dipole, you think you're applying 100 volts to the right side, and you think you're applying 0 volts to the left side. That's not the way it works. Mother Nature tries to force every dipole to be balanced when it's set in the center. She is trying very hard to switch things around such that there's 50 volts on the right side and 50 volts on the left side of that dipole, even though you think you're only applying 100 volts to the right side. She moves in that direction. She doesn't get all the way there. She probably puts 75 volts on the right side, 25 volts on the left side. Doesn't quite get all the way toward balance. However, the 25 volts that's on the left side of that dipole that you didn't apply, that the dipole in its experience of trying to force that balance, put 25 volts on the left side. The left side is connected to the shield of your coax cable. That dipole will now launch a 25-volt RF signal on the outside of the shield of your transmission line. Your transmission line that used to be a beautiful shielded structure just became a radiator. That transmission line is now part of your antenna. Part of the tuning of your antenna is the length of that transmission line as well as the length of that dipole. Let me drop. So a dipole behaves that way, and a direct connection between a transmission line and a dipole, it works, but it's less than ideal. If you now put a one-to-one balun transformer, a one-to-one balun, at the end of your transmission line, that problem would not exist. The completely floating secondary winding of that one-to-one balun will now apply 50 volts to the right side and plus 50 volts to the right side and minus 50 volts to the left side on this half cycle of the sine wave. The balun will allow complete balancing of the way you feed that dipole, and that system with that balun will now launch no signal into the shield of your coax cable. Your coax cable, the center conductor goes to the right-hand winding of the primary of that balun. The shield goes to the left-hand winding, left-hand wire of the winding of that balun. And that's a perfectly proper way of using the balun. The balun is made to go between, in fact, the word balun really stands for balanced to unbalanced converter. You've got an unbalanced so-called coax cable going into the primary of your balun, and the secondary is now a balanced load. And they're completely compatible once you've got that one-to-one balun in there. So, now, you could make an antenna that has, let me pick a number, a 200-ohm impedance. You could therefore buy a 4-to-1 balun. Let me drop it. Where your antenna has got a 200-ohm impedance, the balun is not only doing the balanced-to-unbalanced function, it's simultaneously doing impedance matching. So you could have a 50-ohm primary and a 200-ohm secondary on that balun, and the 200-ohm secondary is connected to your 200-ohm antenna. So in that particular case, it's doing both functions, impedance matching and balancing. but the main primary function of a balance is to handle the situation of an unbalanced source and a balanced load, and it could do the reverse, but that's the way it happens most of the time. The first time you hear this, Jazz, I know it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You got to hear it a few times before it starts sinking in as to what's really going on. But a dipole wants to be fed in a balanced manner most of the time. There's an exception to that rule, and we'll get into that at a later time. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Ben, what's comment?
Somebody said comment. Take your time and give us your full call letters and name, and then tell us the comment.
WB2GXM, Rich, with a comment. The way you just described the Balun one-to-one, wouldn't that be a better solution than a common mode choke? Sounds like the common mode choke is a brute force method of balancing the dipole. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good comment, Rich. However, the word brute force has both a complementary and a non-complementary. If I wound a poor man's balun by taking the right number of turns of coax cable, the right diameter of turns, and the right number of turns, and hold it together with a piece of tape, and you're creating an inductor in series with the shield of the coax cable. The signal flowing down the center of your coax, going through those multiple turns, it doesn't know about that. The signal is flowing down the center of the coax, and the fact that the outside world is looped around, it doesn't know it. So it doesn't affect the signal in any way, but now you've created an RF choke on the secondary, on the outside of the coax cable. By way of the number of turns and the diameter of the turns, you can go to the appropriate chapter of the ARRL handbook. You plug in the numbers for diameter and turns and spacing, and you'll calculate inductance in microhenries. If at your operating frequency, that choke has an inductance in microhenries such that at your frequency, 2 pi X of L equals 2 pi FL. In other words, you plug in the frequency, you plug in the number of microhenries, and you multiply it by 2 pi, you might come up with, let me pick a number, 5,000 ohms of inductive reactance. So ordinarily, let me drop. Ordinarily, you connect your coax cable directly to a dipole, and your dipole, in my example, where you're putting 100 volts on the coax cable, and the dipole ends up putting 75 volts on the right side of the dipole, 25 volts on the left side, and you're launching 25 volts down onto your shield of your coax cable, in my example. Your coax cable is hot, the shack is going to be hot, the coax cable is part of the tuning of the antenna, there's a bunch of disadvantages. You put a 5,000 ohm inductive reactance in series with that cable. You can call it brute force if you want. 5,000 ohms compared to a 50 ohm coax cable is what? I think it's a 100 to 1 ratio. Whatever amount of current wants to flow down the outside of the coax cable, you have just cut it down by 100 to 1. Well, if I take that 1 to 1 balun of yours, it has a certain amount of stray capacitance between the primary winding and the secondary winding. It does an extremely good job, but it's not perfect. It may also be launching a very tiny amount of signal back down the coax cable. It's cut it down by 100 to 1. So can you do it with a balun? Absolutely. Can you do it with a so-called brute force, poor man's balun, the number of turns? Absolutely. And so you and I have the ability to calculate the number of turns, the number of microhenries, the amount of impedance. We can compare that impedance, compare the 50 ohms. If the number is big enough, you stop worrying about it. The amount of current going down the cable is going to be so small, it's now academic. So brute force is not necessarily bad, Rich. WB2GXM for any comment. K2LAW in the TechNet.
Elegant description as always, Rich. Thank you very much.
Okay, we missed the first couple of words in the beginning. Please repeat that last message, Rich.
Dick, just saying I appreciate the description. Very clear. Thank you, WB2GXM.
Yeah, an awful lot of the rules of thumb I use in antenna design, some of them could be called brute force from one point of view. But if you're smart enough to know the magnitude. I mean, there's a big difference between rape and murder. There's a big difference between brute force and doing it elegantly. Sometimes brute force is good enough if you're smart enough to know the details, if you know what I mean. Go on with the next one, John. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Okay, now we have a science question. Yes, some of these kids are a riot. All right, this high school student is making a globe. It's approximately 18 inches in diameter. And while he's doing this, and he has the mountain ranges in, and he has it in scale, pretty much, what he would like to know, which his teacher couldn't answer, is as he's doing this, he noticed the depth of the abyssal plain, the Marianas Trench, and the Atlantic Trench. And he'd like to know, if anybody knows, and maybe you do, Dick, how did they occur as the Earth was developing? What caused that? He understands plate tectonics and things like that, and how they're moving. But how did those trenches start? Where did they come from? And now, of course, they're full of water, so water had a place to go, but where did they get that depth? Maybe you got a clue, Dick. Back to you, KC2WGB.
Yeah, part of the center of the Earth and quite a few of the layers of material from the center toward the perimeter are molten magma-like material. Magma is an extremely hot and extremely high density, very slow moving material, and if it wants to move over the next 100 years in a particular direction, and if you think you're going to change it, you're wasting your time. You're spitting in the ocean. That magma, when it wants to move, has a huge amount of force. What makes it decide it's going to move in this direction, I don't know. But that magma is moving underneath one of those plates in the process of the movement of plate tectonics. When two of those plates come together and crush each other, and one becomes subductive, one curves under the other, you end up with something like Mount Everest and the Rocky Mountains and so on. So those plates moving together can give you, over the next million years, maybe 10 million years, they can give you some huge mountains. Those mountains may only be growing by 1 inch per year. It may be a half an inch per year, but you wait enough years and you get a pretty big mountain. So as those plates move together, you get mountains. As those plates move apart, you get great big valleys. And so, do the plates favor mountains or they favor valleys? They do whatever they want to do. So when those plates move apart and those plates go down as far as the trench, that plate may easily be 30,000 feet deep. And when those two plates move apart, you're going to get a great big notch in between the two. So there are places in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean where material is bubbling. Let me drop this. There's a great big trench along the Atlantic Ocean where magma-like material is bubbling up along this trench. And so Africa is moving to the east, and South America is moving to the west, and we have good reason to believe at one time the two of them together were notched together like two pieces on a puzzle, and now they've moved apart by lots of thousands of miles because of this material is bubbling up in the Atlantic Ocean down halfway between the two. So those plates move very slowly by our standards. They move with a huge amount of force by our standards. And they're being pushed by that magma that's flowing underneath, pushing against the underside. And how that magma decides what direction it's going to move and how fast it's going to move, I think you can come up with all kinds of theories on that. But it's in the big picture, it's an extremely powerful force. It's an immovable object. It's an irresistible force, if you know what I mean, John. That's what little I know about plate tectonics. So it goes both ways, mountains and valleys. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
All right, thought I'd leave a little room in case somebody had an opinion. Very good. Okay, so you think that it's possible that the motion of the plates causing the separation and the areas like the abyssal plain and the Atlantic Trench and things like that. Okay, must be interesting doing this globe project because he started out with a small styrofoam ball and he packed it with clay enough to be able to make that. I think the Marianas Trench is supposed to be around 34,000 feet deep or something like that. It's deeper than Everest is tall. Good stuff. All right, I'm going to drop my one to the last one.
Yeah, let me put in a couple of words on this one, John. When you're making that 18-inch diameter globe, you have a huge problem of scale factor. Earth has a radius very close to 4,000 miles. I think it's around 6,500 kilometers. I'm going to live in miles. Roughly 4,000-mile radius, roughly 8,000-mile diameter. You and I care an awful lot about that atmosphere. The majority of that atmosphere only goes up, I think it's roughly 6 miles. Yeah, the majority, 90-some-odd percent of the atmosphere is in the first 6 miles from the surface of the Earth. So when you compare 6 miles of atmosphere compared to 4,000 miles of radius, suddenly realize that whenever we draw a picture of the Earth and we draw a picture of the atmosphere, we draw a nice thick layer of air above the Earth on that picture. When it's only 6 miles of atmosphere out of 4,000 miles of radius, the scale factor is such. The thickness of the paint on that sphere, on that globe that you buy, the thickness of the paint is not very much different than the thickness of all of the air that we care about. So if 6 miles of air is roughly the thickness of the paint on your globe, you suddenly realize that when they give you mountains and valleys on your globe in order to try to give it a three-dimensional effect, they drastically change the scale factor so that there's something you can see. Within the scale factor of reality, the Rocky Mountains versus the plains in the center of the United States, you almost wouldn't be able to see the difference because the Rocky Mountains are only a fraction of a mile high or 2 miles high, if you know what I mean. 2 miles out of 4,000 miles radius is very, very...
Repeater, timeout.
So when he's making this globe and trying to give it the trenches and mountains and valleys and everything else, he can either decide he's going to use a scale factor where he's multiplying the altitudes and the depths by 100 to 1 so that you can see it. But if it really was the ideal scale factor, an awful lot of the details you're talking about would be almost invisible on that 18-inch diameter globe. KC2WGB, K2RIWM at TechNet.
Yeah, he's aware of that, Dick. He's KC2WGB. He's trying to do it to scale, and he noticed as he was making the trench, of course this has no water on it, so it's just a good topo of the Earth, and he's got it pretty much where he wants it, but that's when he realized, how could this thing be deeper than Everest is high? And then he wondered what caused it. What gouged it out? So I'm sure he has enough information there to chase it further. I'm sure he could probably Google some more information. It's always good.
Yeah, when you watch one of the volcanoes in Hawaii doing their erupting, or a volcano in Iceland doing its erupting, and you look at that red glowing magma coming out of the ground, you suddenly realize that stuff is extremely hot, extremely thick, extremely dense, extremely heavy. Wherever it wants to go, if you think you're going to stop it, oh boy, not a chance in the world. And that's just one little trickle of magma coming out of a volcano. You've got hundreds of miles of diameter of magma, maybe thousands of miles of diameter, that's moving under one of those plates. And when it wants to move that Pacific plate, which is a huge chunk of area, but there's a lot of magma underneath flowing in some particular direction, applying force, the number of pounds of force it can supply is just a huge number. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Yes, and if it's the mud type that are similar, you know, that are popular in Hawaii, you get that flow and that traveling and all of those tubes. But if you get the water steam type, which you don't missile weapons that blow up and destroy everything. Wow, what a pressure there. And look at Mount Surat, what it did. That island, they're still not living over there. But good subject. All right, let me let drop put one for the last one. Okay, have an amateur here who is listening to the discussion on the slow wave structure of a Yagi. And he understands exactly what you were saying. But now he's turned it around. He says, you have a Yagi, it has a 5-foot capture area or an 8-foot capture area. And it brings it down to this slow wave structure or lens and brings it over. And we get the signal. Now, what about reciprocity? When we use it as a transmission device, does it go through the same slow wave, but now it's going out into that 5-foot diameter as a projection? Or is it pencil beam? Or is that part of the pencil beam? That was his question. Actually, the reverse of what you were describing. So maybe you could answer that, Nick. KC2WGB, back to you.
Yeah, that is a very good question, John. And the answer is yes. Reciprocity, all passive antennas, in other words, antennas that do not contain amplifiers, circulators, and other exotic devices, purely passive antennas, directors, reflectors, driven elements, booms, all that kind of jazz, obeys reciprocity directly. 5.5-foot diameter chunk of signal coming into my 19-element 432 megahertz Yagi, where all the directors are roughly 1 foot long. Your first question is going to be, how in the world can 1 foot long elements gather 5.5-foot diameter of signal? And the answer is, let me drop. The first few of those directors, you could say, grab onto the first chunk of signal that's roughly a 1 foot diameter and slow it down. Mother Nature doesn't like a discontinuity. So now, near the boom, you've got some signal that's flowing slowly. You've got the signal that's undisturbed yet outside of that area. And you've got a transition between the two. And those lines of transition, you don't make a sudden step function. There's a slow transition between the signal being slowed down near the boom and the signal outside of the 1 foot diameter directors up front that are no longer affecting the signal. Well, as that plane wave of signal progresses down the boom further and further toward the driven element, some of the signal outside of that 1 foot diameter area starts folding in by the exact same Huygens principle. Huygens principle basically says that if you're able to convert your planar wave coming in into a concave wave, each little subsection of the signal propagating along that curved surface always propagates at right angles to the phase front. That's what the Huygens principle says. So this slow wave structure really, although your eye doesn't see it, your eye only sees 1 foot diameter of stuff when you're looking down the boom. Let me drop it. It is a synthesized magnifying glass, which really acts like a magnifying glass that is 5.5 foot in diameter. It's a distributed structure along the 13-foot length of that boom, but you could synthesize it, you could make an equivalent, you could make, in theory, a magnifying glass out of the right material, 5.5 foot in diameter, and as long as your magnifying glass operates at 432 megacycles, it will focus the signal the exact same way. And what is the magnifying glass doing? And my example is taking a 5.5-foot diameter signal and focusing it down to the driven element. That's what's happening when you receive. Now let's see what happens when you transmit. Let me drop. Every isotropic antenna radiates a signal that is a space front that is a spherical. It's a spherical wavefront. If you go to the right article on the so-called bubble diagram, it's also called radar cross-section, the article by K2RIW that you're going to find in both the mic number one and the mic number two websites. Mic number one is amateurradio.tangovictor, and mic number two is limarktechnet.com, I think it is. Or is it .org? I think it's .com. Anyhow, each of those websites, I've got some articles by K2RIW, and one of those articles will tell you my impression of what you would see if a dipole was transmitting. You stand on from the dipole, and you watch the dipole, the leading edge of the signal, you've just turned on the transmitter, and the leading edge of the signal is just starting to be radiated by the dipole. What would you see? Let me drop. All the diagrams you see in the book of the antenna pattern of a dipole in three-dimensional space is a donut. That is the antenna pattern. The pattern is a phony representation. The distance of that pattern from the origin tells you how strong the signal is in that direction. If your eyes operated at 432 megacycles in my example, and you watch that phase front coming out of the dipole, would you see that donut-shaped pattern? Absolutely not. Be a bunch of spherical bubbles. Every wave coming out of the dipole is a spherical bubble that's being inflated. The spherical bubble is bright in some directions. That's broadside to the dipole, which is a lot of signal, and the bubble is very dim in the directions off to the edge of the dipole. That's where it radiates very little signal. But each individual phase front coming off that dipole is a nearly perfect sphere that's being inflated, and it's moving out in its inflation at the speed of light. But in order for you and I to see this, we've slowed down the movie, if you know what I mean. Okay. Every antenna radiates a spherical wavefront. When it hits the slow wave structure while you're transmitting, that is the magnifying glass being used in reverse. You're now taking the point source spherical wavefront out of the dipole and converting it into a planar wave, and that planar wave coming off the front end of the dipole, the portion that you care about, has a 5.5 foot diameter. So you're taking a planar wave. Can we drop it? That planar phase front, and when you're receiving, you're converting it into a concave wavefront that really is a portion of a sphere, and now the signal collapses onto the dipole when you're receiving. When you're transmitting, you're doing the exact same thing in reverse. The spherical wavefront hits the slow wave structure and gets converted into a planar wavefront. Every feed horn in front of every parabolic dish is emitting a spherical phase front signal. When it bounces off the parabolic surface, that converts it into a planar wavefront. All high-gain signals have a planar wavefront, not a spherical wavefront. So by whatever means that you take the spherical wavefront coming out of any emitting device, whether it be a feed horn, whether it be a dipole, whether it be a loop, anything that emits a signal, the phase front comes off there in a spherical wavefront. When you stand away from it, a couple of wavelengths. It's a spherical wavefront. It's a whole bunch of bubbles that are expanding. And a bubble that's expanding is an isotropic signal. It's got very low gain. But if you've got some kind of a focusing structure that takes that spherical wavefront, converts it into a planar wavefront, in the direction where the planar wavefront is moving, you've got gain. That's where the gain is coming from. It's another way of looking at it. It's a magnifying glass being used in reverse. Let me drop. You could, if you want to, take the signal that really, a very bright dot from an arc welding. Somebody is doing arc welding. And you put the right kind of a magnifying glass in front of that arc welder, where you've got the magnifying glass set up so that the hot spot of the arc is right at the focal point of that magnifying glass. That is now a collimator. Ordinarily, that white dot where the welding is taking place emits a spherical wavefront of very bright light, and it lights up the whole room. You now put a magnifying glass at the focal point. Now, in the direction where you've got the magnifying glass aimed, you've got a much brighter circle of brightness on that wall in front of that magnifying glass, if you know what I mean. You've created a planar wavefront which favors the signal in that direction. So the lenses on a projector being fed with an arc light are doing something like that. We call it a collimator. It really is a magnifying